Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Inside the Monster with Steve Perrault and Joey Capone.
Welcome to episode 61 of the official Red Sox podcast, Inside the Monster, presented by Odyssey with myself, Steve Perrault, and Joey Capone. Today, we are soon to be joined by 2013 Red Sox World Series champion Jake Peavy. Now, Joey's got a bad cough today, so Joey did not join us. Hashtag get better, Joey. Coming off in New Orleans, it may have got the best of him. But Peavy was great. Peavy was absolutely great. A lot of great parade stories, a really funny Brian Butterfield story. He really dives into the mentality of being a great pitcher. If you don't know, which you should, Jake Peavy was a dog. He was literally a dog. He actually converted from a dog to a human. No, he was that guy, man. He was so dominant in 2007. Really, in his, you think of him as his Padres career, and then he becomes more of the savvy vet that gets a couple of rings in 13, 14, and really just has a all-around incredible career, is now doing MLB Network. He's on TV, and I think he's been awesome doing that as well. He pitched for the Savannah Bananas this year. Jake Peavy's got a lot of stuff on his resume, and the best part about it is that he does an incredible job of storytelling of these big moments of his career and his life. And we get all of that in this episode. I honestly think this is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done in my life, and I don't want to put it... I feel like I constantly am trying to, you know, oh, this interview... Jake Peavy was awesome. There's no getting around. He was incredible. It's over an hour. A lot of talk. We talk about everything. We break down him facing Barry Bonds, giving up his the 700th home run in Barry Bonds' career, and some parallels, you know, Pujols and Aaron Judge going for the Triple Crown. Peavy won the pitching Triple Crown in 2007. So we weave in a lot of the current topics, and he's just awesome. Peavy was really good, and I don't want to wait any longer. We are going to get right into this interview with Red Sox World Series champion, 2007. Cy Young Award winner, All-Star starter that year, Savannah Bananas legend, Jake Peavy.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Alrighty, we are joined by two-time World Series champion, three-time All-Star, Cy Young Award winner, Gold Glove winner. He's basically done everything you can do as a pitcher in baseball. Jake Peavy, how you doing, Jake?
I'm wonderful, pal. How are you?
I am doing well. I was going down your accomplishments, and I already knew you were a stud. I kind of grew up with, you know, you were one of the big guys. But how awesome is it to win all this stuff? It has to be great to have all these trophies to you know. It's like, this is what I was doing. I was this good to show everybody that might not know.
Yeah, look, it's fun to look back and reflect on the career as a whole. And you don't really do that as you're playing, and you do win some awards here or there. But I tell you, those championships are everything to me. You know, it was fun winning a Cy Young. It was fun doing it unanimous. I had a coach, Rick Sutcliffe, who pushed me hard to. He was an 84 recipient of a Cy Young Award and first put that idea in my head of being the best pitcher in the league, and then drove me to the unanimous decision, saying, hey, it don't matter if you don't win this thing unanimously like he did. He won it unanimously after being traded midseason, which is even crazy. But no, looking back on those, it was special, and it was nice to be recognized by your peers in the league. But 13 and 14 will forever hold just when I think of trophies and I think of my career, it wouldn't have been anything without those 2 years.
Yeah, and we'll absolutely dive into that. I did want to talk about the Padres years a little bit off the top here. I know you made your debut in 2002 against the Yankees. Kind of a random question here. It was at Qualcomm Stadium in San Diego. What is it like pitching in a multi-purpose stadium? Because we all know about the Coliseum and the reviews that gets. So what was that like back then?
You know, I played the Coliseum quite a bit, and Qualcomm certainly has some Coliseum qualities, but look, I thought it was the best place in America, and it was the nicest facilities that I had ever stepped foot in. And, you know, it was this arena, you know, the old Busch Stadium, and, you know, the Coliseum, just with Alex Avila on MLB Tonight the other night, and he got asked the toughest place he's ever played, and he goes to Coliseum in the playoffs. Those football stadiums really have a way of holding the noise and just creating mayhem in a bowl, you know, which a lot of the new baseball parks can't really do. Qualcomm had that feel in my first start. You know, if you check the attendance out, I think it's 60,000 plus. That doesn't happen at baseball games. And what a way to get baptized. You know, here's the New York Yankees and 60,000, see what you can do. And had 20 plus family members all out there on credit. You know, we just maxed everything out to get high school coaches. But what a day. You know, I just had a kid from a town that we have a ranch. Gunnar Henderson with the Baltimore Orioles just a few weeks ago made his major league debut. And anytime Bubba Thompson, another kid for Texas from Mobile, Alabama, and you watch these kids go through this, and it takes you back to, you know, God, what are we talking about? 20 plus years ago now, getting old.
I know. That is kind of crazy to think about. But yeah, no, I just remember, you know, Padres, Yankees in the World Series there, what, in the late 90s. So it is different looking back at those stadiums. I know in your third year in the majors, you were only 23 years old, but you were the major league leader in ERA. What is it like being in that kind of a zone at that young an age?
Well, yeah, 2004 was kind of a coming out year. And, you know, the first few years, you're just trying to get on your feet. I was in the NL West, which was laden with Barry Bonds and Jeff Kent and Sean Green and Luis Gonzalez, Steve Finley, Todd Helton, Larry Walker. I mean, my division was just crazy of the lineups that I felt like I was facing on a nightly basis. It was far from Double A, which I got called up from, pitching in Pac Bell or Oracle, you know, or Coors Field, trying to get the Blake Street Bombers out. So those first 2 years were just kind of, I felt like I would go out and put a good start or two together, and then I would have that start that I would go 2-3 innings and give up a touchdown and an extra point, you know, just ugly. And in 2004, David Wells joined the team, and Woody Williams was on the team. Kevin Jarvis, another name that maybe not a lot may know, but a great baseball guy and had some good years. And these were veteran pitchers that kind of helped me establish routine. And you know, once you get in your routine, it's easy to now get into your job and make things go. And Darrell Ackerfield, Darren Balsley, my pitching coach in Double-A, had now found his way to the major league, so I was comfortable in that relationship. A lot of good things happened, and we just moved to Petco Park from Qualcomm Stadium, as you mentioned. 2004 was the first year for Petco and also Citizens Bank, I believe. Both of those were 04 years, but a lot of things just went right. And you just, you know, and I was growing. I got to the big leagues at 20, 21 years old, and now I'm 23. I felt like I was still getting bigger and stronger and better.
Yeah, I mean, it's impressive you putting up those numbers at that young an age. I don't want to bring up a sore subject, but I feel like you're okay to talk about it, giving up Barry Bonds' 700th home run in that same year. Of course, we got to, you know, talk about the ups and the downs here.
But I mentioned, absolutely.
I know we're all watching and seeing if Pujols can get to 700. And as a nation, we're looking at it a little differently than when Bonds reached that number in 2004. A lot of steroid rumors going around, a lot of talks of, oh, is this clean? What is it like, you know, at that time for you, not just giving up like a milestone home run while you're having an all-time season, but what was it like amongst the players of how you viewed Barry Bonds as an athlete, and just, is he doing it right? How was that? How were those conversations like in the clubhouse?
You know, look, I'll just be kind of broad off the top and say there was a lot of things going on when I got in the league that you know, were probably blatant, obvious if you wanted to point them out. But it was just a different time and place. So I never partook in any performance enhancing drugs or did any of that stuff. And I can, you know, say that from the bottom of my heart. I did do it clean. And you do look back at guys who maybe weren't and go, God, that's not fair. You know, especially when you want to talk about Alex Rodriguez and then continuing to cheat and try to cheat the system. I have big problems when it gets there, you know, and then, you know, suing us, the union and all. But long story short is I never, when Barry was breaking the record and the Balco in 04 and it kind of steroids was all around what he was doing, it didn't matter to me. I can tell you this. I never faced a player in 15 years that intimidated, that brought to a lineup what Barry Bonds brought to that Dodger lineup. And this is with Jeff Kent, an MVP, hitting right behind him. And yeah. Buck Showalter is walking him when the base is loaded. This is crazy behavior, right? And that's warranted when you have this crazy, extraordinary talent. And I don't know if you remember the Gagne at bat, just 100. You know, that was back when nobody was throwing really 100.
Yeah.
Barry just had, you know, look, he's certainly much bigger man back in those pictures. And when I think about facing him than when I see him now in San Francisco. So think what you want. And we all kind of know what happened. But God, what he was doing on a baseball field, there was nobody anywhere close that was doing it like that. So I got up in early in my career, and you talk about me coming of age, guys like that helped me. We were on some losing teams and I got to go after him. And you know, I hung my hat when I was able to get the best in the game out or strike him out. And so, you know, I faced Barry that night and giving up 700, it's a little breaking ball that I was trying to steal a strike on. You know, I give him a hard time and say, I'm just happy you didn't put, he hit it to left center. So it just barely made it out.
It got out, but yeah, it was the first row. So it wasn't that great a homer.
But he couldn't pimp it because he didn't know. You know? He couldn't do his twirl around and do all his thing. But, you know, and then again, look, I'll tell you a fun story that we should tell because we're on this. I faced Barry in his last at bat that he ever had in that ballpark professionally. We had the game in hand and I served him. I was trying to serve it in there, and he hit a ball right out in that right center field. He hit about 415 feet. But
yeah,
we had such respect in a long run of this is, I don't know, 7, 8. I'm bad with years, but I'd faced him since 2002 on a regular basis. We knew each other. So to face him in that last at bat, us up 8, 9 runs at this time, and I could give him his moment, which he was so close to having. But we embraced him running off the field after Dave Roberts caught the ball, I believe, in center field. You know, he'd give me a big hug and a lot of mutual respect between me and him because I feel like my maturity as a professional and the confidence I got from facing him in those early years went a long way.
Yeah, if you hit a ball in right center at that park, it feels like you got to hit it 600 feet to get it out. And I'm watching these games, we'll get to MLB Network. You're crushing it there. When you guys have these Giants games late or coming off a Giants game, it genuinely feels like. And then you got the wind coming in off McCovey-Cole. It's like, you got to hit the ball 700 feet to get it out there. It's crazy. It helps you as a pitcher, of course.
It was a beautiful place to pitch. Aaron Judge, I think San Francisco is going to be players in this Aaron Judge market. If you just took the ballpark and all the adjusted home runs that they can do nowadays and put him as that as home ballpark, he's probably got 20 less. You know what I mean? And that's nothing against the dude.
No, it's true. Just,
I watched Buster and Hunter Pence and some of the best Pablo Sandovals. We had some great guys. Brandon Belt, big-time left-handed power. Brandon Crawford. Their stats should have an asterisk and say we played in the biggest ballpark. And, again, windy, cold at night. The ball didn't travel.
Yeah. Tough place to play there for sure. You started the All-Star game for the National League in 2007. When did you find out that you were getting the ball there, and how much did that matter to you overall in your career accomplishments?
Well, you know, that was a really cool thing. I went to the All-Star game in 05, and that was right after 04 when the game tied. And they were like, this can't happen again. We've got to have guys in reserve. So I was young. I just will never forget sitting in that first, we had Tony La Russa. So 04, the Cardinals must have won the National League because him and Dave Duncan and that crew, incredible coaching staff, had the All-Star game. But when you have Tony La Russa and that staff at an All-Star game, you're also having pitcher and catcher meetings. And like, it's a serious business for Tony.
It's a real deal. Yeah,
that's right. I couldn't believe we had this stuff happening. But again, that first time I was in a room and it was Clemens and Chris Carpenter was right next to me, and Billy Wagner. Look, Ichiro was like in the lineup. Billy Wagner speaks up in this pitcher meeting. He goes, fastball's in. All you got to do is throw this guy fastball's in. And I'm sitting there going, you're left-handed and you throw 100 miles an hour. Of course you're throwing that. You know, how are we all getting him out? You know,
yeah,
it does
seriously.
Nothing, Billy, but thanks. That was an incredible room. And that night in that room, I said, I will be the extra guy that if this thing goes in extra innings, I'm a starter. So just hold me back. And I was the only guy not going to pitch in that game. That game was decided, and Tony La Russa called me down to him on the bench. And he goes, hey man, this is your first one. This is not going to go to extra innings. You need to get in the game, go down and warm up. And this is like the eighth inning. And he brought me in. And I only got a couple outs, but he gave me that experience. I was super appreciative after it happened. I didn't really think I would. But now we kind of had a little bit of a relationship, and I loved facing those Cardinal teams. And they were really good with Pujols in the middle of them now by this time, and Roland and Jim Edmonds, Larry Walker, David Eckstein, Reggie Sant is stupid.
Yeah.
And so going against them and a Chris Carpenter and Matt Morris and the dudes they had over there was personal to me. So I'd had some good starts against him, and it was, we always made some good eye contact, spoke to him in the tunnel. And then I knew I made the All-Star team, and on that Sunday got a call into Boach's office. It was Buddy Black. And went into his office, and Tony was on the phone and said, hey, man, me and Dave talked about this. We want you to start the game tomorrow night. And, yeah, it was just a super cool moment looking back on it. Getting to start a game is something super special about that. And the other experiences at the All-Star game were certainly far from the one in 07 when I started it.
Yeah, another moment in San Francisco. I feel like you had a lot of really, really cool moments. I mean, obviously, then you end up playing it. You had a lot of great moments in San Francisco. That's a huge part, obviously, of your career, looking back on it, before you even got to play for them as a player. I know in that 07 season, you win, like you mentioned, the Cy Young Award unanimously. Another cool thing you do is you won the Triple Crown as a pitcher with most strikeouts, wins, and the best ERA in the National League. How much did it matter to you getting that Triple Crown? And I know as Aaron Judge is trying to do that now, hitting-wise, being the first since Miggy in 2012. Do you guys look at that differently? I feel like the Triple Crown, we're trying to diminish so many of these accomplishments. They're still a huge deal. Like batting average and leading your league and batting average, all the stuff that still matters. How much did it matter to you to get that Triple Crown in 07?
You know, I can honestly say that I never was on the baseball field thinking about any kind of stat or what was to come of that. You certainly knew the position you were in because, you know, in September of that month, I said it earlier about Rick Sutcliffe in the unanimous thing, the unanimous decision, like, because the reporters are, you know, Aaron Judge is likely MVP, and they're telling him that at the beginning of the month, and you have a month to finish. And if you're thinking about any of that within any of your four at bats, you're beat. Or trying to get a result to make something happen, it's just the losing battle in my mind. And so Rick Sutcliffe just really pushed me in that last month to go, hey, man, I know you might can win one. He goes, I mean, anybody can win one. How many of them have been won unanimously and went, be the best in the league by far? And just kept me in the right mindset to work, grind, and forget about the nonsense. And looking back, I'm just so appreciative of that, because who knows how it would finish. That season, unfortunately, finished in 163 in Colorado with that 14-inning game. No replay. We might have still been – our replay would have been involved.
Game still be going on right now.
Yeah, double play.
I can't believe that. Yeah, no, that was my next question about, you know, you guys end up playing probably around, what, 500 ball maybe the last couple weeks, and the Rockies were on a ridiculous run. They had won whatever it was, I think 12 of the last 13, and you end up tying after 162. You got to go to Colorado. You're starting in that game. It ends up in chaos, but what's your mentality in a wild card tiebreaker game? You don't get them too often. I mean, it's all different. There's like three wild card teams, but at that point, it's all like every baseball fan's watching that one game right before the real playoffs start.
Yeah, no, it was a shitty draw. Excuse my language. No. You know, we had flipped the coin and knew that we had to go play this game if it needed to be in Colorado. Like, how to take the best pitcher in the game out of his element is put him in on the top of a mountain and tell him to do what he's normally doing. Like, there's just that X factor up there that Colorado stuff just doesn't. And back then, especially, it just was always kind of an ever changing thing. And that was what made me uncomfortable. And I was so confident that year. And we had Chris Young, the general manager now of the Texas Rangers, who was in right behind me in numbers wise and as good as I was. We had a really good staff top to bottom, and we loved our chances. Just a side note, this, we had finally, for the first time in my career in San Diego, added at the deadline, and we got Milton Bradley, who was hitting third. But in the last week, 2 weeks of the season, we lost Milton Bradley hitting third, left field, and we lost Mike Cameron. Mm-hmm. And Brady Clark was playing center field that night in Colorado. I do remember Scott Hairston, who ended up hitting a huge homer, was our left fielder. But they just weren't, at that time, the Mike Cameron and Milton Bradley, that what they were bringing production-wise. So we were a little bit banged up going into that game. And then you go up to Colorado. It goes back and forth. I give up a homer to Helton late in that game, a solo home run to tie it, and then it stayed tied in 14 innings. And God, I think maybe when you ask me about the Cy Young, this, you know, you bringing something to my mind, and I hope I'm not getting too long-winded, but it's a podcast, so I figure we can listen.
Exactly.
But when I think back on 07, I think back to that plane ride from Colorado to San Diego and our season being over and trying to console or sit with my buddy Trevor Hoffman, who had just blown a save in Milwaukee, to Tony Gwynn Jr. And I mean, this, our clubhouse was ready with champagne and closed off multiple times in the last week of the season into like blown ninth inning saves, and then you get in extra innings, and then this night to stay the course until the top of the 14th. You're every time from the ninth inning on, your life's on the line. You go up a run, you're done. To hold the fort, Heath Bell needs mentioning in that night. He had an incredible run. Scott Hairston hits a 2-run homer in the 14th. I know. Now here we go again. Our locker room is wrapped and they're ready, and nobody scored since then. And to give up 3 in the bottom half of the inning, and again, it ended on a controversial play where we're all like, he didn't touch the plate.
He didn't touch the plate. There's just no chance.
Then we immediately go in and see that he didn't touch the plate. And then to get on a plane, your season over, and you go get on that bird, and you go back, and it's go home. It was just devastating way for a bunch of men who had high hopes, who we made the playoffs in 05 and 06, but got bounced early by the Cardinals in both times. We felt in 07 we had made some adjustments and were ready. and then not to get that chance hurt. So maybe that's why the Cy Young is just kind of, you know, because there was not even playoffs attached to it when I felt like we could get in the playoffs and I knew I was the best in the league. And like, come on, boys, it's my turn to show up and take you for a ride.
You deserve that home start, like a game one. That probably would have been, a game three, probably back in San Diego. Would have been nuts.
I pitch in San Diego against Colorado. You probably look at the stats. I probably had, and it's a different game
anywhere else.
And look, it was actually my fifth day in that last game in Milwaukee, and I lobbied to start that, but it just wasn't meant to be. They said, no, we'll win today, and then you'll start game one in Philadelphia. Is how it was going to go, but we lost, and
it's brutal. It obviously downs, that's the game, but it's like, you know, I remember that vividly, but then went back to watch it last night, and by golly, he did not touch the base. There's just no chance. Has he talked about it? Have you guys talked about that at all? You and Holiday?
We laugh about it. Yeah, we're good buddies. We're on a Nike trip, and I love Matt, and like, again, competing against him so long as I was in San Diego, he was in Colorado. We love each other, but we laugh about it. And he knows he didn't touch the plate. Look, remember, his chin got all, like, slid head first. Like,
and the way he's looking back at the plate, it's like he kind of knows that he didn't touch the plate. And the ump's kind of like, safe,
should I go back
I
and touch it? Yeah. Great umpire, too. It's Tim
McClellan, right?
McClellan, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Timmy McClellan, I mean, as good as umpire as there ever was, is making that call. So, you know, cheers for replay. You know,
I know, replay.
Could have used it a few years earlier.
Replay is great. I do want to get to the Red Sox, obviously, but you did spend 5 years in Chicago. How would you sum up your time there and what really sticks out to you from your days in the South Side?
Well, you know, my hatred for Detroit, which we had to get through, and how good they were, the team that we end up beating in 13 to win a title, that was the team that we could never climb over in the Central. They were just so good, as we saw in the playoffs, and it took an extraordinary effort to get over. But I loved my time in Chicago, especially I went over there and went through an awful – I felt like John Lackey in Boston. John Lackey came to Boston hurt.
Yeah.
You know, it's why they put that in his clause. You're going to have this. Your elbow stinks. When you go out and you try to pitch through that, you're not this. Boston thought they were getting this John Lackey. Well, when you're hurt, you're not that guy. And so I feel like John got, you know, I went through that same thing in Chicago. If I showed up there, had immediate success in 09 down the stretch. And then in 10, I was hurt from spring training on until blowing out my lat. And then they're like, hold on a second. You're the number one, you know? and so that was tough, but I went through a long rehabilitation. And in 2012, when I didn't think I was ever going to pitch again, and I never was the same, like, you know, I would have killed to been any time before 2009 on the Boston team, because I'd have been expecting to do what John Lester did, you know. Yeah. And why 07 stings is because I was ready to carry the load and thought that I could help really win a title. After the lat injury in Chicago, I thought 2012 was going to be it. I was throwing 85 miles an hour in 2011 off this, trying to see what I had. And so I worked hard through that winter and came back, and it was the last year of my contract, and I just thought I was going to play out because, look, surgeons wouldn't even operate on me. You know, the best surgeons of all, Check and Jim Andrews and Luis Yoakum, you know, God rest. These guys were kind of scared because nobody had ever operated on a lat. It ended Kerry Wood's career and Flash Gordon and Roy Halladay, you know, end up having a lat, and they just never could bring it back. So I kind of took a flyer and had surgery by Anthony Romeo, and he said, look, we'll try this and you can probably come back and relieve. I don't know about your sustainability. And so that was kind of leading up. That was in 10. So 11, you're a year plus out and didn't feel like it was even going to be possible. And then I worked hard through that winter and stuff just started to click in spring training. I came back and I won pitcher of the month in 2012, we had turned over a new leaf and had Robin Ventura over there. My best bud, Adam Dunn, was with us. We had some good teams that were oh so close, but we never got the playoffs. And like, I'll tell you this, and for all the any Southsiders listening, which I don't know if there are, I love my time in the South Side of Chicago. It's blue collar over there, and they're the stepchildren of Chicago, and I identify with that, you know. And we were close, but no cigar. And you know, getting healthy in 2012, and then pitching to an all-star, campaign there got me to where they wanted me back. And so I signed with Chicago before free agency, another two-year deal, which got me to 13 when I got moved at the deadline.
Yeah, you get moved at the deadline, obviously, to the Boston Red Sox. When did you hear the news, and what was your reaction of, I'm going to be pitching at Fenway Park. I'm going to be one of the guys for the home team instead of an opponent for the first time.
Look, I need to start by telling you, in 2013, my like gal was my grandmother, right? I called home on the days I started. My grandmother, I never made a start without speaking to my grandmother. I mean, this started in high school. But I called home and she would always tell me, you tell them boys now in there, this is our year. We're going to win the World Series. And, you know, you tell them, now don't throw that ball in there where they can hit it, baby. And I love you. Bye, Grandma. And she passed away in January of 2013. And in her bedroom, she told me she loved me. And I was getting ready to go to spring training with the White Sox, 13. And she told me, the last things that she said was, when you get down there, you tell them boys in that room that this is our year. We're going to win the World Series. So I went to 13 camp with a heavy heart, but truly thinking that, like, hey, we're going to have a good team. And it just didn't work out. And now I went through a little bit of a hamstring stuff and was trying to prove that I was healthy before the deadline, because I had talked to Kenny and Rick Hahn about being moved. And there were some teams with interest if I were healthy. And I went and made a rehab start and knew that there was stuff going on. And look, I spent a lot of time, maybe too much time, in Daisy Buchanan's there in my time in Boston. And Daisy Buchanan's Fody calls me. And he goes, you're coming to Boston. And that truly, before any agent, before the team said anything, before I knew anything, the guy from Daisy's, my best bud, Fody, texted me and said, hey, man, you're coming Boston. And I'm not kidding you. Within hours, it started to unfold. And I can't tell you how happy I was. I had David Ross, who wasn't active at the time. He was on concussion protocol. But I had some familiar faces in the room. I had tons of guys over there that I had huge love for. And then to come be a part of the Boston culture and tradition and play in Fenway Park. And so at the last of July, I was moved and I made my debut in Fenway Park with the Boston Red Sox home uniform on my grandmother's birthday.
Oh, wow.
So, that's crazy. So like the press play thing and almost that story was written, you know, when those bombs went off in April, you know, that all that stuff was kind of scripted. And Johnny Gomes says it best when he says, man, you guys really put the city on your back and took us to this unbelievable. And Johnny said, I think we kind of feel the opposite. If we just climbed on the city's energy and in the back, that Fenway Park was on fire. You know, we were the only game in town after the Bruins lost in the finals to the Blackhawks. And there was just a hunger, you know, everybody walked out of the garden, let down and thinking that, like, you know, and I just, that now the Red Sox are the only game in town. We're scrapping with Tampa Bay trying to claw in, and that larger than life energy. They asked me on the network, what are you looking for? And I'm like, in these last couple weeks, man, you want to see this team having fun in the team with intensity, but good vibes and good energies and that are playing good baseball.
Yeah.
Because it's just about getting in. And, but like, you know, I'll shut up after this, but that story in 2013, making my debut in Fenway on my grandmother's birthday, there was just so many factors at play of like, man, this is written. I walked in that clubhouse. I tried to beat everybody there. I said, I'm going to get to the clubhouse before anybody. We were playing a late game I got there about 12:30. Normally that's beaten most players to the field, but Petey was there. Salt of Lamacchia and Johnny Gomes. There was three guys in the room when I got there. And Petey was walking out when I was walking in down to the field, probably already in uniform and to do something. And I said hello to Johnny Gomes, and me and Johnny had been fierce competitors at this point in time. I didn't like him. Yeah. You know, I didn't like any position player I didn't know, because it was just, I felt beneficial for me to kind of not like you. I did better against you.
Gives you an edge. Yeah,
that's right. And I say to Johnny, "How you doing, Johnny? What's going on?" And he said, "Man, I'm doing great, P. It's another day close to the parade around here." And I said, just kind of got through that and said, "Look, I'm happy to be here. Whatever, man, I'm on board." Walk over, and I got put next to Johnny Lester, and Salt of Lamacchia was in the corner kind of across the room. And I got over to Salty, and me and Salty introduced, and I said, "Man, what am I missing? It's July in Boston. What kind of parade is Johnny talking about?" And I truly had no idea that he was talking about it. And Salty looked at me, and he goes, "He's talking about the World Series parade, man." He goes, "We're winning the World Series here." And I, at that moment, I had this, like, I knew it was true. Like, I looked at him and I go, "That's exactly what I'm here to do." I truly can get emotional thinking about it because of my grandmother and just that story. It just all was too good not to be true. So we at kind of that whole, I mean, I don't know if you remember, but I mean, we had shirts and it's a press play, like, "Don't get in the way of this. It's written. Just do what we need to do accountability wise to make sure that we have no way of getting in the way of this thing," kind of deal. And that just became about accountability within the brotherhood. A couple tugs on some beards and hoist the trophy.
That whole run was incredible. And I think you being a part of it mattered so much, because not only did it bring a veteran and a guy that's kind of been there, done that, but it was, you just kind of fit that personality of the team. You talk about the beards, the bearded brothers, all of that. I didn't know that story about your grandmother. That's crazy, especially that it was her birthday on your debut. That's pretty wild. How much do you buy into the baseball god stuff? Because I know certain players don't and some do.
If you don't believe in the gods in general after that, what I just told you, you can't make this up.
Yeah.
And it's just, like you said, there's just things in life that we all have to acknowledge. We're very small in the grand scheme of it all, you know, and we have it relatively easy in our worlds, no matter as bad as we think we might have it.
Yeah, that was
why I felt to add that. But we do have it very relatively easy. And I'm in one that believe that you know, we have this spirit in us that like, I'm not preachy in any way, believe what you want to believe, but the baseball gods are real. They are real. And I say it all the time too, and the baseball gods have a huge part in this, is there's two types of baseball players. There's humble ones and there's those that are about to be humble.
Yeah. I like that. What was your favorite part of that run, that 2013 postseason run? I know you get a start in each series, in the DS, the CS, and the World Series. You're pitching in Tampa in that clincher for the
ALDS.
Yeah.
And then the World Series start, bowing our neck and getting out of bases loaded, jammed and stuff. I hope people understand. Yeah, getting hit for there hurt, but
yeah,
early in that start. But I take pride in that World Series start of Ben, don't break. And if people know one thing, we held as much ground as we could possibly hold. And I don't remember getting out of a bases loaded, no out jam at really any point in time in my life. But if any point in time, you know you need to get out of it, so when you're in the World Series and one on the road. And then to come back and be in – we lost that – the way that game got lost. And,
got
some nice fines after – you know, a game shouldn't have ended like that in May in
terrible.
Miami, much less the World Series. But – you know, the Tampa, the Detroit start was just awful in that grand scheme of things. The Tampa Bay start, I certainly take pride in of if we don't win that game down there after the walk-off in game three, we have to come back and face David Price. And David mm-hmm. Price was death for the Red Sox at this point in time. And so, you know, me and Salty got, you know – six innings down in there, getting into the sixth inning and doing what we were supposed to do and us finding a way to win and celebrate there was huge. But my favorite part of that are the relationships from Tommy Mack and their whole clubhouse staff, the training staff, you know, just getting to be back in Boston and see Russell Nua, who put his hands all over me and allowed those championships to, and all of us to make these things work. Mm. Every relationship, Jack McCormick, to the front office and the PR personnel and Sherry Catherine. I mean, just we, Meg Ryan, we were such a family from like all of those people. And then the players, the relationships that I have with these boys and the opportunity to play with all of these guys that I have so much respect for. And we are now the best of friends of 10, 15 guys that really genuinely were, you know, not all alike in life, but we just were bonded in a way of we're going to make this happen and will it to happen. And I'd never experienced that. So to have that, and then that just spilled to all the names that I can't even believe I just got into mentioning names because there's too many, from doctors to Dave Brady and the security team. And it was just this monstrosity of big time love for each other and energy. And like all of those people knew we were going to win the World Series. You know what I mean? And it was a part of their daily walk in life, and no matter what we were doing. And so, man, that's just what stands out to me of like, man, I felt like I was home when I got there. Like you said, I had so many other dudes that were kind of edgy that made some money and didn't need a whole lot of anything else. But, you know, when I told you in 05 and 06, we got bounced by the Cardinals. When we got to the World Series, I stood up in the room and I said, I owe these guys. Like, I want to come through. Same with Detroit, you know, and John Mackey starting Detroit, you know, just that. But Mike Napoli in that clubhouse right behind me after I said that, he pipes off in Texas, you know, almost got it done, that Nelson Cruz play in right field.
Yep.
You know, and Nap goes, look, don't stop now. These boys are, you know, I owe them too. And it was just a beautiful brotherhood of guys that were, but we had fun after it, too. I think about me and Nat walking down Boylston with his shirt off and thanking God the next day I didn't make that picture.
That, I mean, now that we're on the celebrations, obviously, got to ask about the duck boat. So when I think of Jake Peavy in Boston, I think of that Rays start shutting it down and getting into the ALCS. And I think you buying a duck boat after you guys had that parade in Boston that you talk so much about. When did it hit you, like, I want to buy this thing? And then what's the whole process of getting that back home?
Well, we had, I mean, and this is a true story. Again, you can't make this up, because we hung out so much in suites of hotels that we didn't go out ever. You know, it was far gone in our careers of going out to bars. And the only time we left is when we went and had a big, nice dinner. And we would, again, there would be 15 of us at a steakhouse in Toronto, and maybe more than 15. And we would leave out of there, and a couple of us guys would probably pick the tab up, and we would leave 15. And Brian Dempster would have this plan of, look, we're going to Brian Butterfield's room. But we knew Butter went to bed super early. This is an off day in Toronto. And we went and had Petey knock on Butter's door and act like that he was struggling and wanted to talk to him about hitting. And we had the whole team in the hallway right outside the door. And when Butter opened the door to let Petey in, we bum rushed him. And everybody piled him on his bed and just give him the nookies. And then we got off of him, and Dent took control of the room. And Dent was like, Butter, we just left the big show dinner and we're winning the World Series, and we're not sure if you're ready. Game 7. You're going to call these signs right down there. Give it to us. And he's in his underwear. You know, I'm ready, boys. And that just, I don't know if that's happening or will. I hope it happens today. But when I see clubhouses today and I see everybody on their phones when I'm in there, And I know that 15 guys aren't going out to dinner on an off day, and just that camaraderie that builds is huge. And we had that in a monster way. And so we sat in these suites, and Johnny Gomes, this one night, I had this ranch in Alabama, and Johnny Gomes said one night out loud, and that's where the idea really originated. He goes, "Man, when we win the World Series and we have this double, you should buy your duck boat and take it to the ranch in Alabama." Meanwhile, like in the winter, we all came, like these guys would all come down in January and we'd spend a long weekend on the ranch and what we call guys weekend, you know, good, clean fun. That's where the duck boat got its first paint job, by Johnny Gomes. There, but long story short, he says in about August, "You should do this." Then we actually win. You win on October 30th. That spills into the wee morning hours, mid-morning hours of the 31st. You get some sleep, and I got up, and we took the kids out for a little bit. And trick-or-treating in downtown Boston, it was amazing. Then put them back to bed, back to Daisies, back to the boys and mayhem, you know. And then now it's parade morning and day. This is the day of just sheer joy, and I get there, and they give us, me and Lester are on a boat together, and they give us 6 tickets apiece. You know, you get you plus 5 others. And at this point in time, I had 3 boys. Only 3 at this point in time. 3 boys and a wife. My brother and his family were there. My parents were there. My grandparents, you know. And I just couldn't imagine waving to them on a corner, and I'm going to be in this great space for 4 to 6 hours. And that's really when it became, I spoke to the driver of the boat. I was figuring out I wasn't going to get 6 people on, any more than 6 people in this boat. Didn't matter what had happened, because there was some ownership folks. You know, there was, this thing was planned out.
Yeah.
And I wasn't trying to be disrespectful, but I was also wanting the experience. Like, life experiences and memories are everything to me. And man, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I spoke to the owner of the drive of the company through our bus driver. She put me in touch with a female who owns the company. We negotiated a price. I had checks there. She just took the World Series title. Is my check going to be good? And I wrote a $75,000 check before that parade that morning, and that duck boat became mine. The owners, previous owners, displayed, you know, let the Red Sox know that I had made this purchase, and I was able to weasel some more people on my boat now. And
so you owned it by the parade. By the parade, you technically owned it. That's awesome.
Oh, I didn't know that. To get my family on it.
Yeah.
to be like, "Look, I hate to tell you guys, but this is my boat now." and me and John are going to get the proper people on here. And you guys can come too. Like, we actually can put more on my boat. We'll break the rules a little bit, you know.
Yeah. It's your boat. Do what you want.
And look, I'll tell you another thing about it being our boat is, speaking of Daisy Buchanan's, Joe Cimino had at the after party, he goes, I love the Red Sox so much. I want to put Daisy Buchanan's on there, and we'll get some good play of this. We spent too much time in this place." Not so on the back of that duck boat, it had a big sign that said, "Daisy Buchanan's loves the Red Sox." Just in proper form, you know. But what a wonderful day. Like, that day, I just remember and telling my dad, "Make eye contact with these people," and the sheer joy. And You know that there had to be so many people, that the last time we gathered like that in the streets was Marathon Monday. Yeah. And so it was just emotional. And Johnny putting the trophy down and saying, "Look, remember and tell people, hey, this is where the bombings happened. But don't forget to tell the rest of the 13th story of, man, we overcame as a city and celebrated not too long after, and commemorated and remembered the fallen ones and the heroes." But, you know, Boston, what a badass story. You know, I mean, the city just shut down. How cool was that? You know, I wasn't even a part at this point in time, but what a display of power of stay home, stop, time out. This doesn't happen here. And then the powerful Ortiz speech afterwards, and you know, it was just amazing. You know, all the way down to Johnny Gomes and the Boston Strong, you know, just a like I said, the story was written. We were just happy to all be a part of it.
You couldn't script how that season went. Like, you really couldn't. I wouldn't believe it. Just like, I was just lucky to be in Boston when that was going on. What you guys were doing, and I don't ever want, as the years go on, I never want it to be like overdone. It's like, because it's not being overdone. What the Sox were doing mattered so much to Boston. Like, I can't remember a sports team and a run mattering more to what was going on in the city. It was just in links.
Right. That's right. It was just a huge synergy between all of us. And like I mentioned earlier, that Johnny said it properly when we got on the backs of that energy and knew that there was something here in our fan base and in the city. And you look at when Houston pulled it off amongst the tragedy, and you just look at any point in time that a city's been through something, and sports, we know, kind of brings us together and helps us all feel like we're one, you know, kind of heartbeat. That's what was happening there in a huge way. And like you said, we're all just lucky to have experienced it. I hope that people remember it like that, because it wasn't 04. You know, 04 is just that, you know, but the full 13 story is just an amazing story of what Boston is. It's title town. And then don't mess with us. Come here and mess with us, and we'll shut it down and make you pay. And local law. I mean, I just thought it was badass. And like I said, to come, when I took my jersey off, I had the black, you know, the blue, you know, Boston police stuff there, yeah, proudly across my chest under my jersey, because of how much just the whole movement meant.
Only a few more for you. You've given us a ton of your time. Really appreciate it, Jake. I know in 2014, you get dealt to the Giants. You become the second starting pitcher ever to win two consecutive World Series championships with a team in each league, which I thought was interesting. What was your favorite part about being on that third World Series title team in five seasons for the Giants?
Well, look, when you talk about me believing in baseball gods and everything, so my father and grandfather wore the number 22. And I wore that all the way up through high school, through my minor leagues, when you pick your number, until I get in the major leagues. When I got to the major leagues, I didn't ask for a number. I just had number 44 in my locker. Seemed to be fitting, because I'm from Mobile, Alabama, which is where Hank Aaron is from. And 44 is a big deal here. Willie McCovey's also from Mobile, and he wore 44. I wore 44 all the way through that Boston championship, and now I get traded back to San Francisco. And when I say back to, my original manager for the first 6-7 years of my career was Bruce Bochy. He's now in charge out there and is having success. And so very familiar situation that I was going to. I was going to the man that had raised me, and I knew what he was valued in the game, and it just was heaven sent. I also play music a little bit, and it's just kind of therapy for me. And I've been along the way. The guy who taught me to play guitar and gave me my first guitar at 20 years old was the third base coach in San Diego, Tim Flannery. He was now the third base coach for the Giants, and the band was back together, you know. So my favorite part was linking up with those guys and being the only trade that San Francisco made, and feeling like you had a lot of the recipe and the will to make it happen, and joining a group of guys that had already achieved that as well. It was just heaven sent. And I went on a really nice run statistically in the second half there with those guys. When I tell you the baseball gods are funny, I got out to San Francisco, and the first thing they tell me when I walk in, I say, "Hey, guy, you can't wear 44 here. It's retired Willie McCovey, yeah, who's from your hometown. You'd like to meet him?" For the first time, he's in the hallway, wants to say hello to you, along with Willie Mays, and just it was amazing. But I couldn't wear his number, and so I said, "I'll wear 22. Surely 22 is retired. It now is retired in San Francisco." But I got to go back, and I couldn't believe it, because I love Will Clark and I was a huge fan. But it wasn't, because at that time you had to be a Hall of Famer for your number to be retired in San Francisco, and Will didn't quite make it in. He should be. But anyway, I got to wear 22, my number that I had grew up wearing in San Francisco, back with my original manager, back, I mean, I had games where I pitched in Oracle Park and I went and played the Fillmore with Phil Lesh and Tim Flannery. And like, it was just the most heaven sent of music, baseball, hippie experience that, man, I when I told you I felt like I was home in Boston, I again found a second home on the West Coast in San Francisco with that whole scene musically. And look, they loved the Giants out West and they loved us. And we were 3 and 5 years, you know, was considered like putting a cap on a little dynasty run, and to get to play a part in that was rather cool too. And look, to tell you like another thing about how that Boston 13 team worked, what John Lester and David Ross did to have so much success in the playoffs, I promise you, I took that same philosophy and to Madison Bumgarner, and Buster, and was saying, look, this is the way these guys decimated lineups in the league, and let's do a lot of this, you know, if we can. And you know, Bumgarner was a big Lester fan, and so he was all ears. And then you think about, we had to get past John Lackey and the Cardinals and get past then and then 14, I left that 13 team and won. In 15, the Kansas City Royals, who we beat in 14, they should have beat us. They couldn't. Who did they sign? None other than Johnny Gomes. Johnny Gomes, huge factor in those guys getting in the playoffs. And then even when he got left off a roster here or there, he spoke at the World Series parade because of how influential he was. 16, again, 13 teams all over it with Blackie and Lester and Ross leading that charge to do it in Chicago. Who'd they play? Andrew Miller, Mike Napoli on the other side in Cleveland. That team had a bunch of dudes that really understood baseball, being a professional, accountability, and friendship. And when you combined all of those things, which all of those guys I just mentioned for 5 or so years or a couple, you know, you just see this trickle down effect of those guys were just all up in the playoffs and winning again and again when we were able to unlock that code in Boston.
That is very awesome. Back-to-back parades has to be pretty great too. I can't really beat that.
Look, I miss the team playing home from, we had so much fun winning in Boston. Was amazing, and I wouldn't have had it no other way. But and there's nothing like that first time, nothing like it. Yeah. But winning game 7 on the road in somebody else's ballpark and hearing that place go completely silent, and then you got about 300 fans and friends that you can now for the first time hear because it's so silent and you're celebrating on that field. That was the second time it happened. I even tried to get more people there. I had people at the Wazoo, and it cost me a pretty penny on getting back to San Francisco because we went so hard. We missed the plane back and it left at like 4 or something. That's awesome. We got back the next day and in time for a beautiful parade down in San Francisco. The parade in San Francisco had some amazing artwork that we probably shouldn't get into here, but they had some like the opposing team's announcers and some of the national broadcast announcers that they didn't feel liked us. They would put their faces on these big cardboard signs and they would be doing all kind of acts with them. It was incredibly creative, but only, you know, San Francisco and the West Coast would bring out that. That's a highlight of that parade out there.
Yeah, creative's a good word for it. That's for sure. I know you were with the Savannah Bananas earlier this year, and I didn't even realize this when you used your gold glove, which is awesome. What a badass move! You're like, I'm going to use my gold glove. What was that experience like?
Well, look, I got to know Jesse Cole as he started building this Savannah Banana brand, and I thought it was genius from the first time hearing it. And if you say the words fun to me, I'm listening. You got me. I like fun. And man, everything Jesse does is fun. And I had kind of walked away from baseball thinking that it was getting stale and it was really analytics were just stripping the complete soul. We just talked about 13 and we didn't talk about any analytics. We talked about the soul of what happened. And that's what we love and what we recognize with as fans, not these numbers that these robots put up. And I'm not hating on analytics because I believe there's a marriage and compromise in it all that we're going to find. But again, I was just kind of burnt out and this was a completely different idea and entity. We were looking for things to do. I'm on the board over here at Hank Aaron Stadium and we've lost our double 18, which has been awful, but we're trying, we're Hank Aaron's name and his stadium is going to live on. And I'm trying to make that a priority. And so the Savannah Bananas were somebody we did a one city world tour to Mobile. It was the first time they took the show on the road. And I've just had this friendship with Jesse ever since. And he's been trying to get me to play. And then I have a little boy that's 8 years old who don't remember. He was born in that championship 14. He was born. So he really doesn't remember dad playing at all. And he wanted me to play with the Savannah Bananas, and they're his favorite team. So here we go. This 41-year-old got out there, and Jesse wanted me to come with style, and I didn't know any style. Style was, you know, I'd grab the gold glove off the trophy case and just said, I'm going to go pitch with this thing. I'll probably need to show it off because they're going to be hitting the ball at me so hard.
I don't think of you as style. You were a dog out there. It was about attacking these guys.
That's right. I just couldn't. I'm like, Jesse, look, I love what you're doing, but it just never was my MO to dance on the field, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know if you saw Papelbon's now joined the madness and the Savannah Bananas are coming and they're coming in a big way. They're going to sell out Fenway Park. I promise you, your audience is going to, in 2024, I would even be bold in saying, but it would not surprise me that in 2024, if these listeners don't have an opportunity to buy Savannah Banana tickets at Fenway Park and it's going to sell out, you can book it. And if I can help it, and I've got a lot of ideas, and I hadn't even talked to Jesse about, and this is getting me excited about, as you obviously can tell, but I certainly am going to be there for that day. I don't know if I'm a banana or a party animal. I kind of mentioned this on a tweet the other day. Like, I don't know if I'm a party animal because that's who the Savannah Bananas play.
Yeah.
But how much fun would it be for Pedro to be in uniform and David Ortiz to be getting an at-bat in this game? And I promise you, when these guys see and feel this, and when their children see and feel it, it's fun around the game of baseball that we like.
Yeah.
So if you're a traditionalist and you don't want to come, that's fine. But if you have children and if you're into entertainment and good competitive baseball, and if you want to make a play in the stands, it can count as an out, you're in the right place. And I'm telling you, anybody that has ever come and been a part of this with me, it has been hook, line, and sinker because, again, we're all about fun. We all have to work, and we all got to be adults and balance life. But we all are little kids and want to have fun, too. The Savannah Bananas are, like, fun from dad age on down to the smallest of those.
They're like Pixar. Like, everybody loves it. Doesn't matter what age you are, it definitely works. They've taken over baseball in a way that I've never seen for a non-MLB thing. It really is pretty crazy. You mentioned
more TikTok followers than any major league franchise.
It's insane. But they target that specifically and do an incredible job of it. You mentioned a fan catching a ball and having it being out. I remember your now buddy, Greg Amsinger, mentioning this to me when I talked to him. God, this must have been 6 years ago. And I was saying, what's one rule that you think would make the game great? And he says, bottom of the ninth, two outs, full count. Foul ball, fan catches it, the game's over. And I remember him talking about that. And so for it to actually be a thing is a little crazy. I wanted that to transition real quick to your time with MLB Network. I think you've been awesome seeing you on there. I'm not just saying that to suck up. There are some players that get on TV and they're a little stiff. You seem to just be yourself up there. But how has that transition been to talking about the game instead of playing, even though you're still playing with the Savannah Bananas?
Well, it's made me fall back in love with the game again because I watch it honestly from my opinion and or my view vantage point, and get to reflect on that, because that's what I'm there to do. I'm not there to compromise on analytics, and you don't want to hear me read stat sheets out there. I had a call yesterday with my coach, who's helping me up there. Bruce Kornblatt has helped a lot of great TV people, and I care about what I'm doing, and I want to be a good representation and good for our game, grow it. I think I've got to be a little bit more of myself and not play it as conservative as I have at times. Because
I think you've been authentic. I don't think you're holding back that much.
Well, I appreciate that, because I am. I take pride in just kind of being here. It is, and that's, it's not an egotistical way. It's just, hey, it's straightforward. I'm going to be honest with you, and you be honest back. If we're not going to be that way, let's just don't talk.
Yeah.
And so I want to bring that to the air, but again, I also have this deep respect for the game of baseball and how tough it is to play, and how you just can't quantify all of this. And there's human element involved, and there's this soul and will to win inside these players that you can't measure. It's hard getting analytical and really criticizing somebody when I've been out there in the same moment and failed time and time again, and know how hard it is to actually do what these guys are doing. So I'm going to find a balance, and I appreciate you saying that. I've had an absolute blast doing it, because I get to be a fan at the end of the day, and I get to watch the entire league and have, get to know all these teams and all the young players, and the game is just full of so much young talent. It's fun to watch for me again.
Yeah. No, you really crush it up there, and ideally they can have you on more. Last question for you. We always end with a trivia question about the player's career. I'm sure you know the answer to this. I just kind of want to hear what you have to say about it. Who was your first career strikeout in Major League Baseball? Do you recall who that was?
I do. That Yankee start.
Yep.
And this got my whole career off to a great start. And I talked about what Barry Bonds did for my confidence, what Derek Jeter did for me, and so graciously swinging and missing a few times. He made a young kid that wasn't sure if I belonged, because Alfonso Soriano, welcome to the big leagues, fastball off the wall. He's standing at second. That 60,000, they weren't Padre fans. There was 10,000 of our normal Padre fans that came, and there were 50,000 Yankee fans. So the place immediately went into this, oh, God. This is what they're talking about. And Wiki Gonzalez calls another fastball to start Jeter off. And I'm like, no. Do you see what just happened? Let's throw the other one. And I threw that slider, and he swung and missed. And I swear to you, at that point in time, I'm like, all right, well, we've got to do that again. And he swung and missed. And then again, he swung and missed to the third slider. And at that point in time, I thought I had it's Derek Jeter.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, this works here against him. Let's do a lot of this, that start was crazy. Give up another hit to Giambi and give up a run, then was able to throw about 5-6 hitless innings until Bernie Williams doubled. And
so you remember it all. You remember lost, are you one of those pitchers that remembers like every at bat? Do you remember all of those?
Yeah,
yeah.
Because they're so personal. I try to explain that, I won't get long-winded. The pitcher, I knew everybody in the major leagues, and why I did that is because there was only 12 pitchers on each team. There was five starters. I certainly knew those guys. They were doing what I was doing, and I knew the relievers. I knew every player in the league because I faced every player in the league. It's different than a shortstop playing against another shortstop. I would tell my dad, I go, Dad, Bobby Cox just wrote down in his office in there his best nine guys, he thinks. And guess what I'm going to do? Walk out in the centerpiece of the field and say, okay, Raffy for call, come on, me and you, pal, get in there. And we go at it. All right, you're out. I'll see you later. Marcus Giles, you come on. It's a personal thing, to you. And so a pitcher knows the league like that. And I feel like when you think about pitchers having memories, they were personal experiences that you had with that guy, and you know if you won or lost most times.
That's great. I just love that mentality, that me versus you mentality, and you could see it out there. You obviously had that, and you carried that with you for your career.
And the center fielders, while all that's going, I'm not taking anything away from a center fielder, incredibly important, but he's just standing there and going, it might catch five balls a night, and there's not –
connection, yeah.
yeah, you know, I had to eat and breathe and sleep what these guys, you know, had to get into those interactions. Whereas, you know, they have to know where to stand. You know, oh, this is this guy in the lineup. We'll move here.
I hear you. Yeah, it's different.
Pitchers, but it's that's pitchers. You know, you get the wins and losses. The lines are made on that guy in the middle of the diamond. I love all these position players. I love them. But that pitcher's mound is the greatest place in the world, and it can be the loneliest place in the world, too. I told David Ross at one point in time in Oakland, he come out there and he got on his knees and where he wouldn't show me up, and he just started giving it to me. Jeez, what is wrong with you? And I go, do you want this? I will gladly put that shit on, and you have this, and let me go back there and say, throw it right here. Not right here, right here. You know, do it like this now. So those good pitcher catcher battles and then position players. But like you said, it works best when that Boston team, we were all, it didn't matter, pitcher, catcher, we didn't want our first baseman, it didn't matter.
Nothing like that 2013 team, I'm telling you. Jake, so thank you so much for your time. You gave us so much of your time, and you really meant so much to the fans in that 2013 season. Anytime we get to talk about 2013, it's the best. It's just different. That season was just different. It was its own thing, and you were a huge part of that. And hopefully we see you back with the Bananas at Fenway Park. I didn't even think that they would be doing MLB tours. Is that in the talks maybe?
It's in the works, but it has to be. This fan base is growing, and it's growing our game. It's getting young people excited about the game. So that's what I'm super excited about. But I appreciate it. And look, to Red Sox Nation, it is just an honor for me to even be thought about in the short time. This is the shortest time that I played in any, and I feel beloved in San Diego and Chicago, Boston and San Fran, but only have a year in Boston, but what a memorable year. Buying the duck boat, I got Boston down here in a development in Mobile, Alabama. It's with me every day, you know. It's got a beautiful paint scheme on it, and gets displayed proudly of where that 2000 story, 13 story will live on. So I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Hopefully we see you at Fenway. I want you on the mound with the Bananas. That needs to happen now. I know you've done it, so you have the experience. We'll see you at Fenway with the Bananas.
You got it. You can book that.
All right. Want to thank Jake Peavy for giving us a lot of his time today. That was a really fun interview. He's just a great dude. What an awesome guy. All around, just great personality. He was, for a guy that was so intense on the mound, a very thoughtful, caring, well-spoken, chill guy off the field. Those are interesting combos. You look at someone like Papelbon. I know he mentioned Papelbon briefly there, who's just a nut 24/7. And constant chaos surrounding Jonathan Papelbon. He's always flipping out, and he is constantly going 1,000 miles an hour. It was really nice to just have people. He was in his kitchen there, just chilling, had some coffee. It was just a great conversation, just a really nice convo with someone that was an absolute baller when I was growing up. And, you know, one of the best pitchers in baseball. In 07, he was untouchable, just absolutely filthy. How that season ended, it's really tough. And I'm glad he opened up about that and was honest about, you know what, 2007 was great, but it just absolutely sucks how it ended. And I think athletes are, they don't want to always talk about the bad times, but I like when they're honest about how much it still sits with them, because it's not all dandy. Even someone for Peavy that's got two World Series rings, got all the trophies, he's got a duck boat on his ranch. I think they got a cable car as well in 2014 from San Francisco when they won that World Series. So he's lived a great baseball life, but he's, you know, very open and honest about the tough times and, you know, about grinding through some really difficult points of his career. And, you know, you look back on it and it's a hell of a baseball life and it's still going. And shout out to Jake Peavy for being that dude, for giving us a lot of time, and hopefully get to meet him in the near future. If he's at Fenway, that would be great. But yeah, PV, that was great. That was awesome. That was a fun time. Next, you'll hear from Joey and I, if Joey survives this cough he's got right now, is after this Red Series, Red Sox Reds, a battle in Cincinnati coming up here. And Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. It's a few games closer to the offseason and all the drama that's going to come with rumors and all that. 16 games left when we record this, and the countdown begins for hopefully a successful 2023 season. But that'll do it for episode 61. For Joey Capone, I am Steve Peralt. Go Sox, kid. Inside the Monster is a production of Odyssey in partnership with the Boston Red Sox. The show is produced by me, Steve Peralt. Our executive producer is Lena Glazer, mixing and video editing by Joey Capone. Special thanks to the Red Sox and Major League Baseball for their contributions to the production of this podcast.